Hey friends, we wanted to take a quick minute and personally invite you to two really special gatherings coming this fall. First, our intentional motherhood retreat in Portland, Oregon, October 15th through the 17th, and then our intentional fatherhood retreat in Austin, Texas, November 12th through the 14th. Honestly, these retreats have become so much more than events for us. They've become spaces where people encounter God, experience healing, honesty, friendship, freedom, and real transformation. We live in a world that is full of information. We have podcasts, books, content, advice, but transformation requires more than information. Sometimes you need space, you need community, you need honesty, you need the presence of God, and you need to get around other people who are fighting for the same things you are. At these events, we've watched marriages soften again. We've watched fathers come out of hiding. We've watched mothers breathe deeply again. We've watched people feel seen, known, challenged, and deeply encouraged. And we would genuinely love for you to join us. You can learn more and grab tickets at intentionalparents.org. And for all things fatherhood, you can visit intentionalfatherhood.org. We hope to see you there. Welcome to the Intentional Parents Podcast. Intentional exists to help parents in their God-given task to raise passionate Jesus followers. We exist to bring hope, help, and healing to families. Each week, we will talk about anything from parenting, marriage, lifestyle, and what it looks like to follow Jesus in our time. Intentional is made up of Phil and Diane Comer and Brooke and Elizabeth Moser. I am Brooke, and the funny thing is, we are all family. Elizabeth is Phil and Diane's daughter, so we're a family figuring this thing out together. We hope this podcast feels like you're sitting with us in our home talking about how to do this thing called life together. Elizabeth and I are your hosts. Let's get into this week's podcast. Today on the show, we have author C.S. Fritz. Now, I'm personally very excited about today's conversation because it's near and dear to my heart. C.S. Fritz is also in my world is known as Casey because that's his real name. That's his given name. And he's a dear friend of mine who I've known for some time. He's an award-winning author. Him and his wife also run something called Albatross Book Co., which is a multi-award-winning publishing and book craft company. He's written endless children's books, and he's also an illustrator. He illustrates every single book that he writes, which is also just such a neat particular way in which he blesses the world, not just with the words, but visually. It's just such a stimulating thing. So I can't wait for our conversation. We're going to talk about some pretty intense stuff today. And his story, as you'll find out, is laced with just deep traumatic experiences, but also the grace of Jesus and how healing has come through the way of Jesus. And so excited for you to hear that. Before we get into that conversation, just want to remind you and thank you. First, the reminder, we are trying to get to 1,000 ratings on Apple Podcasts by June. So everybody that has done that, the second part is thank you. Thank you so much for the kind words. The kind words have been pouring out. And to be honest, Phil and Diane and Elizabeth and I are like often in tears at some of the things that you guys have been saying. So thank you for your generosity and kindness, for all the work that goes into these. It's such an incredible gift to hear from you, the listener. And so thank you for rating. And if you would help us, if you haven't had a chance to rate the podcast yet, or even leave a comment, would you just take 10 seconds right now, 30 seconds to just rate the podcast, leave a comment. But here's my conversation today with author C.S. Fritz. Welcome to the podcast, Casey. So glad to have you today.
I am stoked.
I can't wait to introduce you to this audience, and specifically because I have deep excitement. It's like when you have a good friend and you want someone else to meet your good friend, you're like, oh, I can't wait for my good friends to meet. I hope they like each other. And so that's today. And I'm really honored that you're on the show today. A couple things I want to say just to even as we start is obviously now most people would probably know you as an author, C.S. Fritz. If you have any idea what's good, you're going to go Google that immediately. And if you don't already know, an insane illustrator and author and a lot of great content, which we're going to talk about on this show today. But Casey, I'm so thankful that I get to call you friend, but this started, when did we first meet? Was it 2014? Was that roughly when it was? I think it was. No. Yeah. 2014.
Yeah. It was about a year before I took off to plant a church, which would have been 2015. So that's right.
Yeah. Right around there. So, I don't even know. I'm going to start telling this story, but you can fill in the gaps because you're already laughing because it's funny. So I remember, we've mentioned it on the podcast before, but Elizabeth and I were, we moved down to LA because we sensed that God was calling us to be a part of this church, Reality LA. Yeah. The only caveat or problem was that there wasn't a job available yet, but we still felt like we were supposed to move. Either the smartest thing or dumbest thing. We weren't sure at the time. But I remember in that process, you and I had crossed paths. Mm-hmm. And you were a pastor at Reality LA. Mm-hmm. You were there. And basically, I remember there was this like process of time in which we were waiting to come on staff or hopefully come on staff. And I was like working at restaurants and this whole thing. But yeah, you were leading all of the kids. At that point, you were leading so much. It was crazy. What were you doing there at that time? Yeah. Remind me.
Yeah, I actually was pastor over ministries is what they called it. So essentially anything that wasn't a doer, but wasn't a team of equippers. So it was the counseling care, it was the community, it was children's ministry, youth, so on and so forth. So yeah, I was over it all as more of an overseer level, not on an actual practical everyday level.
That's so many things. And I remember you had so many things to juggle, but in this process, you were a part of the interview process. You were part of the process of me actually potentially even coming onto this team or not. And I remember I interviewed with a bunch of different people and you and I interviewed a handful of times. And I remember thinking, this guy's like, I remember the first time I saw you, you're very tall. People might not know this about you. You're physically tall. You're a human that is larger by nature in the yeah. sense of you just have this persona about you and you have this presence. And I remember you walked in, I was like, that guy's got like a presence about him. And it wasn't just your physical stature, although that does help. It was your presence. You had like this, this energetic, spirit-filled, like, I remember feeling like, oh man, Casey's like, there's something there. Anyway, I remember this process of like interviewing with you and others, and you were actually the one that called when I finally got the job, but you called me and told me I didn't get the job. Do you remember this?
Oh my gosh. I don't remember this. I was just messing with you.
You were messing with me. I'm not making this up. I didn't forget. You called and you're like, hey man, we've been talking for a while. Are you sitting down? I was like, yeah. And you basically said, hey, I'm so sorry, but I know we've taken you through this whole process and it's been a long time, but it's just not going to work out. You know, there's just some stuff that about you that we weren't really comfortable with. And I was like, my jaw was, I was just silent. And then you're like, just kidding. Can you come and sign papers tomorrow?
Dude, I don't remember that at all, but I know I would do it. I used to fake fire people all the time. Like, you know, total Michael Scott style. I would fake fire everybody I possibly could, which is just the worst thing you could do. So a fake non-hire is also pretty funny.
I do remember laughing, but that was the beginning, in my opinion, of a great friendship. But do you remember the interview process? Do you remember it from your end?
You know, oddly enough, I don't remember the interview process. I remember you just when you were actually on staff. I remember just working with you on a day-to-day yeah. basis when you were coming in, because you were taking over community groups, which was the yeah. biggest thing on my plate. So I just remember our countless conversations sitting on sofas of just dreaming and mission and vision and philosophy and your ideas and where you came from and so on and so forth. And we just had a blast, I think, just being together versus giving you this ministry was beyond that. And it was a sweet time. And I remember walking to lunch with you. I remember those details far more than I remember the interview process.
I just thought the fake non-hire was great. So I do remember that. I haven't been able to use it yet, but when I get I've had opportunities. I've hired people, but it hasn't come to mind at the right time. So I'm going to take that from a page from your book. But you're not only obviously an author, but you also are married and have kids. Mm-hmm. Would you introduce us just even really quick to your family?
Yeah, I am been married to my wife since 2005. So I believe that's 17 years. We've been together since 2002, so long time, but we have two kids. Yeah, we have a 15-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter. My son is the kindest, gentlest spirit on the face of the planet, and my daughter will literally start a forest fire if you give her a match. So we have both ends of the spectrum of just absolute wildness and absolute just sensitive spirit. And they're both incredible. And I love them dearly.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. I knew your kids, they were younger, obviously, last time we lived in the same area when we were in LA, but, man, what is this stage of life like for you as a dad, right? Like, so 15 and 13, right? That the complexities are high, emotional, you know, IQ is there. How's it going for you right now in this stage?
We thought, because we were such young parents, my wife is 35 and we have a 15-year-old, so you can do the math.
Oh my word.
So we thought.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she got pregnant within 5 months of us getting married, and we got married when she was 18.
Oh my word. I didn't connect these dots. I'm 36. She's younger than I am.
Yeah.
She's a 15-year-old.
We did the math. I think we did it where we figured out both of our kids will be out of the house by the time she's 39 or something like that. Before she's 40, both kids will be out.
Wow.
But
wow.
We, being young parents, thought when our kids get to the teenager stage, we're going to crush this parenting thing. Crush it. And I tell you what, you know, it's probably true, and you guys have probably talked about it a million times, but it's physically exhausting when they're young, and it's mentally exhausting when they're older. And that is very true. And so navigating their nuances and their needs and their mental health and their schedules has been a bit arduous. It's lovely. And watching them try to figure out their faith is lovely. But watching them make bad decisions is heart-wrenching. And giving the permission to make bad decisions. It's like, okay, I'm going to give you as much wisdom as I can. But when you actually do this on your own at this party, God be with you. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
we've run down all those different avenues of classic teenagers, but I will just say this. I mean, they're both incredible kids who try really hard, who have great grades, who make good choices, and who are radically serving at their church. So all those big check marks have been answered by the grace of God.
Oh, that's a gift. I'm glad to hear that. And yeah, parenting in every stage is so interesting, as especially as dads, as fathers. And, you know, I know you've always been a present father. And obviously, we're going to talk about your books, and I'm really excited to talk about your books, because your books have a really important, you know, kind of not necessarily hidden if you've read them. They're not a hidden thread, but they come from a very personalized place. And what I really hoped to do, because it is fascinating to me, is I kind of wanted to capture where this comes from for you, right? Because we all have a story, and some of our stories start out and they're just like epic stories, and then they just keep getting more epic. Or your story's going along, it's going really well, and then it just like stops, and there's a really challenging roadblock. So I guess what I want to do is I want to hear your story and where this comes from, because all of us have these incredible stories, but yours particularly is not the one that people might think. And obviously you're now using this gift of illustration and writing to help so many people, but that's not always how it was. And so I kind of want to just jump into, like, you know, what was life for you growing up? So let's start backwards a little bit. When you were young, what was life like for C.S. Fritz, or also known as Little Casey at that time? What was life like for you? And what was that process of growing up like? Give us a picture, a word picture of what that was like.
Yeah. You know, on one end, you have this childlike experience where, you know, you go and play in the giant rocks at a beach. You know, as we live in Southern California, you look for crabs, and there seems to be a level of innocence and being a child of the 80s. And you have all of that nostalgia and emotions and, I don't know, remembrance of it all. But then on the other hand, you know, on the other hand, I just came from an extremely broken situation. And the more I process it, like, my mom was just in town, and every time I see her, we process it. That's constantly a process. It's constantly healing. It's constantly emotionally, you know, engaging. And so it brings us together. So anyway,
I was going to say, before you go into that part though, about your mom, you know, it's almost like when you're in that space, it brings up some of those things that were like, it just like brings it back to the surface almost again. You got to feel those things again. Am I right about, do you experience that?
Oh my gosh. No, every time she's in the room, the air is different. You know what I mean? The way you talk is different, or the way they laugh, it reminds you. And so you kind of have to rework through it. Now she lives in Costa Rica. So when we have time together, it's less frequent. So we have to work through it more.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So I didn't want to. So Southern California, the rocks, the beaches, keep going.
I mean, it, in some ways it's everybody's story that we're so familiar with, which what I mean is there's a lot of divorce. There's a lot of divorce, and there's a lot of frustration with the parents and the evil step parents. And so what that means is my dad decided to leave my mom when my sister got home. From the hospital, and that sort of launched this downhill momentum of my mom constantly thinking the grass is greener. And she did that by marrying five men. So she's been through four divorces and five men. And wow. A lot of these guys were less than admirable. And I've actually, that's way too respectful for them. They were abusive, horrible, horrible people. And so I don't know how much you want to get into it. I mean, even one of them was dishonorably charged for forging the signature of the Secretary of the State of the entire country to give himself a Medal of Honor, and was found out and put in prison. I mean, these are the guys that were in our home at our dining room table. And there was a lot of incest within my family, of rape within my family, the amount of, well, the amount of unhealth, addiction is just so rampant. So then you put, you know, this little boy in there who's completely hurting from seeing his mom broken, scared, not sure what to do. And you understand that when there's a man coming in and out, the boy naturally steps up. Any older child would step. I was the oldest, and you step up and you just try to take care of things. And so I was getting a job if I could to make money at age 8 or 10. I'd go pick green beans to physically fighting some of these stepdads to get them off your mother or get them off yourself. So there was a lot of physical abuse, a lot of verbal abuse. And we can go down any one of those, but there was so much angst and pain and fear. All the way through our many moves, I was in a different school district twice the school year. So I was constantly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was about every 6-ish months, my mother or her current husband and her would pick up and move, which was, you know, you leave one place, it's about to start division. You go up in another place and they're like, hey, we haven't done, we're not going to do division. And so you just skip these portions of your life, your education, your experience, and you kind of just bounce around and you're just like, I know nothing. I know no one. I am nothing. I am no one. And these start infecting you. And so, and I love my mom, but she would openly admit today that there were some hard choices made out of real desperation. And if there was a man in her life who said, hey, let's hang out, she would do it. And she would bring him home. So...
Wow. So this is the backdrop of your life. And what would you say, what age would you say that you started to come aware of like, whoa, my life is different than those around me, or maybe my situation as maybe though it felt normal in one sense to you, because it always feels normal until we have something else. When did it start to feel abnormal and you to kind of go, oh, there's something here?
I love that question. I really do, because there was a time, right? There's a time for every kid where they go, you know, this isn't like Johnny down the street.
Yeah.
So that's a great question. I'd be curious to hear for you too, if you had one of those moments, realization. I remember reading in a book that you lose respect for your parents, if I'm using the right word from the book, the minute you realize you'd make a wiser decision than they would. All respect is gone as a child when you realize that you would have made a wiser decision. So I think that was a very, very young age when I had to, you know, carry my mom home as a 7-year-old as she's drunk and I'm dragging her down the street.
Wow. To help her get home.
So there's a lot of, there was a lot of those moments, I would say, where everything started coming together. There may not have been a massive lightning strike, but it was putting these things together where I started to go, this is not okay. This isn't right.
So you, even at age 7, started becoming aware of that.
Yeah, if not younger. I mean, here, my mom's second marriage, the guy left her, and I remember it vividly, and she would tell me the story all the time. I was 4 or 5, and she got, and the husband left, and I remember proposing to her in the middle of the living room, just going, I'll take care of you. I'll be your husband. Not knowing what that meant, obviously.
Oh, wow.
But I got down like on one knee and proposed to my mom, I guess out of whatever it was, and saying, I'll take care of it. Don't you worry. So
Casey,
it's heavy.
Oh, that's heavy. So that was the backdrop of, you know, childhood. How long until you got to the age, like at what age as you're growing up, do you start to become more independent and go, that unhealth is obviously not going to work for the way I'm wired. So I need to distance myself. When did you start? I mean, in one sense, I'm sure you probably emotionally started distancing yourself, but when did you like even just start to physically distance yourself and grow up probably far too young?
Yeah, I do know the day that happened. It was one of the days of my biggest recipient and victimized of abuse. I was physically abused pretty heavily one day. And I got up and I just saw my mom watching. Not intervening, watching. And that was the nail in the coffin. I knew from that day on, this will never be the same. And it wasn't too long after that I just started hanging out with friends longer than I could. Sleepovers were basically every night at any friends I could. And then when I got a car, I mean, they'd see it later. But there was physical distancing was the minute I could. But I do know the day that happens. I could tell you the weather. I could tell you the smell. I mean, it's so right there.
It was true trauma. You experienced true trauma in that moment. Yeah. I mean, from the trauma stuff I've been working through personally, I like the real traumatic events leave these like insane imprints on our minds. It's actually interesting. I had this situation, which I won't go into the details about, but I was sitting in therapy with my wife and we were talking about this story and this traumatic event that had happened while we were dating. And she says, and I had completely, we were trying to recall the day that it had happened. And it was the weirdest thing because I would have just been so sure that the day that I experienced this traumatic event and then the 6-month anniversary of us dating, you know, we're just kids dating. It's a 6-month anniversary. It was a really special day. I had put that 6-month anniversary and the day of trauma like 6 months or a year apart. And she tells me in that meeting, and this is like 6 years ago, she goes, no, honey, that was the same day. And I was like, wait, what?
Wow.
What are you talking about? And we were with a therapist at the time and he was explaining to me like, no, this is very, your brain does this to protect yourself in many ways. And I had like, to that moment, if you would have asked me, I would have told you with complete and utter integrity that they were not even close to the same month, week, day, and they were on the exact same day, you know? And it was just this very, that moment scared me. I don't know about you, but it scared me to think, whoa, how much is going on under the surface that I'm just completely unaware of that's either affecting me or affecting other people. And, you know, obviously that's why we want to deal with these things because what we pass on, what we don't transform, or we transmit what we don't transform. And so, you know, for me, I'm like, I don't want to transmit this to my family. So I do want to transform it, but you know, sometimes how. So anyway, that's a little tangent, but when you, so you're out of the house and this leads you to obviously say, you know what I should do with my life? I should become a pastor, right? I'm tongue in cheek, but obviously that was a genuine call and you're an effective leader, communicator, and pastor. I've witnessed this firsthand. So I'm obviously being funny now, but sincerely, like, yeah, where did that come from for you?
You're very kind.
What was that process?
But you must have experienced this or seen this, that whenever there is trauma, that naturally these victims or whatever step into caregiving roles, right? Like that's seems to be the norm for for whatever it means. It just seems natural. And so even though I didn't know that, what had happened was my mom left her third husband and one day picked us up from school without telling us and moved us to Arizona from Oregon. Couldn't say goodbye to anybody. There's nothing in the car. We didn't know our stuff was packed. And what happens was, is we showed up in Arizona and my mom had this reformation of sorts and like church is going to fix everything. So she forced us to go to like some crazy purity seminar at a Calvary Chapel in Arizona. And thank God.
Crazy purity seminar.
Dude, the guys, like, the guys were like all dressed up in like drag. And they were like, there was a really wild purity seminar. All these youth pastors were just like playing these different roles. It was one of the wildest things I've ever seen. But I got saved there. Of course.
So you met Jesus in that space.
Yeah, dude.
Oh my goodness.
I will say, I think I was craving anybody, and I'd be curious if you've had this experience. I think I was craving anybody just to, for somebody to be kind or to me, or to show me that there's something bigger than myself, or just to show me an ounce of love. And so if I would have walked into name any denomination or any cult, if I would have walked in, I would have accepted their whatever.
But at that point, go ahead.
So the fact that a Bible teaching, Jesus loving church is totally the grace of God, because I just wanted to get out. But it was that moment that I basically just fell in love with the pastors at this church, and that's a whole other trauma abusive story. But I did fall in love with them enough to the point where it was like ministry and my giftings and my wants and the calling I was trying to cipher that was there and all that type of stuff sort of came to a boiling point. And I knew at age 15 that I was like, I'm going to be a pastor. That's it. Period. That's what I'm going to do.
Wow.
And I pointed my entire life and assets and functions, whatever, in that general direction. But that came with years and years of its own abuse from that church. That church is, it's got a lot of issues. But at the same time, I'm extremely grateful for it, you know, in a weird way, because there was so much good. But there's a few individuals there that should not have been in ministry and should not have been.
It reminds me of, you know, I think this verse is totally taken out of context most of the time, which, you know, that's where, you know, when you have a theology is important, but context is so important. But the scripture that does honestly come to mind, because I think it's the graciousness of the experience that you're sharing, like the grace of God, is that he does work things out for good. And that good, I mean, most of the time people say, God works all things together for good. And they often, at least, and this is my experience, but they'll say, my good meaning, my prosperity, my comfort, my not suffering.
Right.
But good actually doesn't mean those things. It means like righteousness. He works all things out for my righteousness. That's what his definition of good is in that space. And so thinking about, like, even though there was men and women in that space that were abusive as well, like how God still had his hand of protection and love on you and worked it out for your righteousness to bring you to him.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And as I'm hearing you say, like all this abuse and you're still standing.
And to that point, if I would have known I was being abused, I would not advocate to stay to allow God to turn this evil into good. I would have ran, and I would tell that 15-year-old boy, do not stay here. But because like you're saying, my ignorance and not enough good guidance or wisdom in my life, I did stay there. And to the you know, the Romans verse, dude, it works out only by his grace. So that was jumping from abusive patriarch to abusive patriarch. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I didn't even realize that it was masked in Christianity, shepherding, the word of God, and all of these things that were supposed to be tools were used as weapons, and gifts, you know, were used as torture devices. And it was just so dark.
Wow. And not to get into the details, but I also think that your story is not that different from many listening, where they've experienced a level of church hurt or church abuse in some way. And for anybody that's listening that has experienced that, and as somebody who is an advocate for the church, and we're going to get more into how deep that actually went in a second, what would you say to that person who's experienced deep church hurt, but still wants to love Jesus, or still does? What would your word be to them?
I'm going to give my response, but please also give yours. And we can dialogue about both. I would work very hard to make the clearest delineation between what is and what Christ wants, between what is and versus who Christ is. And I would work hard to show what's evil, satanic, wrong, versus what's gentle, right, truth-filled, and just constantly work to make sure that first and foremost, the intermeshing of who Christ is not connected to the pain that's been done. But then on the flip side, take that, what you were just saying, what's been done and what Christ can do with it, or what has been done and how Christ can redeem it from the ruins to praiseworthy. I think making those delineations in people's mind to think and understand is probably one of the more important things to do, versus allowing them to come to that realization on their own or never coming to that realization. That's what immediately comes to me from church hurt, depending on what type of church hurt. There's so many nuanced answers we could give, but setting up first and foremost that Christ is as mad as you ought to be, if not madder. Christ is as broken as you are or ought to be, if not more so. And so I don't want to pit something against one another, but I definitely want to show the order of Christ in all of those things. Yes. So what do you think?
Wow. That's a good, I don't have much to add. I think the first thing that came to mind was, I think I would say it differently because my mind uses words in a different way, and that's why you're an author and I'm not. But it would be that your relationship with Jesus, the Father, the Holy Spirit, is connected to the church, but it is not isolated to the church, right?
Yeah.
And isolated meaning that the church is God's design. And when we talk to people, like I have so many conversations, we advocate all the time, even in this podcast, being in regular community in church is so helpful for your soul. At the same time, one of the most beautiful things is that Jesus can work in and through the church, and he does, but he also can work in spite of people's shortcomings. And it's still baffling to me that God... personally, it's still baffling to me that God partners with humankind, who can do so much destruction, to accomplish his will and purpose on this world, in this world. It's just so baffling. And I think the church hurt I know I've experienced, I would say that it's a reminder, it gives me compassion, because you see broken people trying to lead broken people.
Yeah.
And I think, of course, there's pain there. And of course, there's things that need to be healed and forgiven. And at the same time, I think that it gives me compassion to remember that just like those people have hurt, I have hurt. And you know, there's positive learning. Like you can learn from positive things, but you can also have something called negative development, where you develop from the negative, you know? And so I think for me, it always gives me an opportunity to say, wow, what a great example of what I never want to be, and live differently. And because of like having an example so clearly of what I shouldn't do is helpful to me as something I should do.
And I love your point. And I think trying to find them to not take that evil of that one pastor or whatever and paint the church black with it. You know what I mean? Because the church is unbelievable. Like what it's supposed to be is truly unbelievable. And also to your point, it's so funny you brought it up. I think you're kind of talking about how God is using human agency. I can't stop thinking about it. Sort of, it's been in my time with the Lord, but I keep thinking about, and tell me if this is a tangent, forgive me, but I keep thinking about,
we're all about tangents.
Okay. I keep thinking about that. If you read Joshua, in the very early parts of the chapter, he goes through one wall, and every other time after that, he tells his people, "Now you do it." And I love that God does not allow, even with painful things or violence or warring things, God does not allow passivity. God will not do all of the work. And that sounds weird, and that's probably could be theologically stated better. But the point is, I choose to do it with you, not for you. I will do it for you. And God goes through giants, and God goes through seas, and God goes through walls. But then it will always end up with, now we do it. Now go and do it. And so the passivity of all that, even working through the church, if we just have the one breakthrough, or it's just the one time, and then we get up and it's like, God, why aren't you doing X, Y, and Z? There's a very big disconnect with how God works with us and through our lives. Yes, he'll break through some walls, but more than that, there's also times where there's a little bit of, I need the human agency aspect of this relationship or this brokenness or this conquering to happen with and through you. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. It even reminds me of faith and works, that true, genuine faith brings authentic works. It's not, you don't work for the faith or the spirit, that really it's when you are filled with genuine faith, genuine works follow. It's an active, not passive situation. So yes, similar ways to say the same thing. I totally agree. If you're enjoying this content and you want to go deeper, we have an amazing resource that we want to tell you about. It's the Intentional Film Series, Raising Passionate Jesus Followers. Now, this is an incredible tool for you for spiritual formation in the family. And we created this film series to help parents in their God-given task to raise and disciple their own children. Now, our hope is that we're able to help you and give you some of the tools that I know we so desperately need, as we're in the process of raising our kids, and Phil and Diane have actually raised their kids. This is a 9-session film series on the process of what raising a passionate Jesus follower actually looks like. There's some workable solutions in here. There's a bunch of wisdom from the scriptures, and there's a bunch of practical help in your journey as you are raising your children. We cover all sorts of things like parental roles, goals versus values. What is discipline versus punishment? How do I create a heart of obedience in my child where they actually want to obey? What does a heart of self-control look like? Or how do I even help my child in the process of character development? We cover that and so many more things. You can use this film series in a variety of ways. You can use it at your home, preferably with your spouse if that's applicable, with a group of friends or in your community, or even through your local church. All you need to do is head over to our website, intentionalparents.org, click on film series, and then follow the prompts. We have a bunch of other resources there that you can check out, but we do pray that this blesses you in your pursuit of raising passionate Jesus followers. And this is where, you know, I want to get back to your story in a second, but I would ask for you why, like, and I didn't prep you for this question, so if you're like, pass, that's fine. Why is it important, in your opinion, as someone who's been in ministry for a long time, but also as a person who's experienced deep trauma and also has a family, why is it important, in your opinion, to have your family be in church regularly? You said your kids are actively and ferociously serving. Why is it important for families as a unit to be in church, especially after COVID, especially after it's so much more convenient now to just like watch it on a screen? What would your take be on that one?
I think knowing all the biblical tenets that come involved and what it means to be a healthy member of the body of Christ, everything from 1 Corinthians to Ephesians, and what it looks like, and understanding those healthy tenets, everything from not forsaking the gathering in Hebrews all the way to the breaking of the bread and whatever you want to say, all that stuff. We are legitimately designed. Our faith is designed in such a way that apart from it, we are incomplete. And so Zoom church, all that stuff, helpful during COVID. And at the same time, what normally happens, good things can become godly things, and it just can start becoming convenient. And never in the history of church history or faith has church or the gathering or the body ever supposed to be about convenience or about necessarily comforting. You know, it's that classic quote, you know, you challenge the comfort and comfort the challenged, or whatever it is. So all that to say is, if I want my kids to be whole, if I want my kids to feel complete or to step into who they're supposed to be or whatever it is, and all those biblical tenets, having them active, healthy and active at church is a must for their own future and their own spiritual vitality.
I love, well, I'm thinking about my daughter, Scarlett. She's now 10. I know wow. You haven't seen her for a long time. All of our smoke. Kids are becoming, yeah, I know. All of our kids are becoming adults now. This is crazy. Our youngest is 4 and we're like, we're out of all the little baby stages and all that stuff. But she started serving at church in any way that she could. And I will say there was a definitive moment that when she wants to come with me every Sunday morning before for pre-gathering prayer, the whole nine. And she legitimately has come alive in a new way in her faith, not in a way that I forced her, but like serving in the church, being connected to the body, being a part of it, and her having her own friend group, but even the adults like having and affirming her has made her, has just brought her faith into perspective to where she's the other day, she made this note, she has this journal, and I walk into her room and she's like, hey, I'm just writing. I was like, you mind, you know, what are you writing? Do you mind showing me? Are you like, she's like, I'm just making some, like a to-do list. And I was like, oh, what's on your to-do list? She's like, oh, you know, just stuff I'm kind of like trying to aim for. And I was like, you know, like goals. Is that what you're saying? She's like, yeah. Like, you know, I want to read more, and I want to read the Bible more. I want to pray more. I want to be more healthy when, you know, when I think about how I communicate with people. And I was like, what is going on? You know, you're 10 years old, just chill out. And to see like, you know, we could chalk that up to, man, we're the best parents. Not even close. Like that is not even, I know the actual story of our life. That's not why that's happening. I see it happening because she's connected to and with a local church and have people that are outside of her parents affirming her faith and affirming her and helping her. And so anyway, I think you're spot on with that. And I've just seen such a decline in people wanting or even understanding why church is important. And it's just massive. I think it's a massive miss that I really, really do want to pray for families that they can get plugged in. Cause obviously having little ones is really hard, right? Like having little ones and getting them there. Like I understand the challenge so much, but the fruit in my opinion outweighs.
You're right. And I was going to say to the opposite of the fruit is the unintentional damage or what you don't even mean to teach as far as trying to reach children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Is a megaphone to priorities, to what's supreme, to all those things. And so it's not, oh, let's just miss the Sunday. It's the rhythms that children need are being removed. And that just has, I'm being redundant now, but that just speaks volumes as to what we are all about as a unit. So I could not agree more about the dangers and the beauty of making sure that a family is present and active and healthy. Not even just, also the other middle danger of going and doing or being nothing, going and being a spectator. That's also just as dangerous.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, because you go to consume and then your faith becomes a consuming one. And when God doesn't meet your needs in your way, there's frustration and confusion, but that was actually never how it was designed in the first place. Well, to keep us on track, because I don't want to miss some of the best part of the story. So you get into ministry and tell me, give me the, like a little bit of the progression of ministry. So you step in and you start where, and, you know, kind of give me your journey of pastoral ministry real quick.
Yeah. The real quick hits would be, being at that church I was, if you want to be a pastor, you got to learn how to plunge a toilet. So I was in pastoral development, which was clean toilets, be there at 3 a.m. when it snows, leave at 9 p.m. after the pastor leaves on these days. And sometimes our days were just long and heavy and hard, but that was all supposed to be part of the development, which is very intense. And so I'm not saying that's a healthy way of doing it because we didn't learn boundaries, but there was that was part of my story. And so between that, children's ministry and, this is something you and I have in common, even though you're 1,000 times better than me. It's just playing drums nonstop. You're such a good
drummer. That's not true. That's not true. You have some blast beats that could really save some souls, man. Could bring them in with that.
So that was basically it for that time. And then it was just starting to hone in on what I wanted to be and what I felt like I was called to. And before church planting was a term, it was just, I just want to be a senior pastor. Or I just want to start a church. And that's just what that term was. And so
is that what the voice is that, is that the voice that's the senior pastor voice? Got it.
Let's go.
I love that. That's
let's
perfect.
Go. Let's pioneer. So that was basically, and then I started to hone in, and the church that I was a part of went through a massive church split, which gave me more responsibility because I stayed. And just did crazy ministry, overseeing everything, but I was dying and feeling something inside of me that was so thirsty just to start and plant a church. And you know, it sounds so sexy now to be a church planter, but then it just wasn't even my mind. I just wanted to, I just loved the church. So that's what led me to go, they're not going to change. They're not into church planning. They're not into sending me, because it just had a split. So I said, I got to find something. And that's when I was introduced to Reality LA. And Tim Chaddick, who we both know, who's a phenomenal preacher, just can preach the pain off the walls. He's just so gifted. And I started listening to his discs. I don't even think he had a podcast then. That's how old it was. I was like literally ordering their discs. So I just went through that entire process. And the short of it is, I was a pastor in Arizona. We had two young babies. And this is where our stories intersect. We had two young babies. We owned a home, and we said, this is insane, but God is calling us to leave this and go live in the heart of Los Angeles and give it all up and be a part of this crazy church. And that's where you and I have similar stupidity.
And which I'm thankful for. I am thankful for now for sure.
So yeah, Reality LA, you know, I remember I had a meeting with the executive pastor there at the time, who ended up co-planning with me, but I had a meeting with him, and he's like, we can't offer you a job, but if you want to come be on mission with us in the city, you're welcome to do it. And my wife and I are like, great. That means everything to us. And that means nothing to us. And so we gave it all up, moved into the heart of North Hollywood. It was hella hard, crazy. And the most rewarding, I don't want to say spiritual time, but just the rewarding chapter of our entire life. Absolute dependency, absolute excitement, just to drive through the city and be at that church on Sundays. You know, it was the first time I was ever part of a living church. I was always a part of dead churches, but I was like, this is what an alive church feels like. And I knew it and I could sense it. And so just being there was electric. So I was, I was just going to say, I was brought on staff 9 months later. And then that starts a whole other venture, but that was
cool. So you're on staff for 9 months, and then how many years were you on staff? Because obviously you did end up planting a church, so you were on staff for how long before you went to go plant?
I think we showed up there in like 2010, and I was brought on 2011. It was Halloween, so I was brought on Halloween.
Your favorite holiday. My favorite. Your tattoos tell me so.
I was brought on Halloween, so it would have been something like that. So it must have been earlier than 9 months. I don't remember how the exact breakdown was, but they were hiring a children's director. I had so much children's ministry experience. I said, absolutely, I just want to be a part of the team and how I can help, and if this is what you guys need, sign me up. And went in there and was part of that whole process, and was sometime later appointed as an elder there, and then a couple months after that appointed as a lead pastor with the guys.
Wow. So let me just highlight one thing that I think is really important. Now, obviously, unhealthy church situation, abuse, no boundaries. We get that. I also think we're in a time where we need to have some opportunities for our kids to remember that Jesus was like a servant leader, right? Like that there's this dynamic in the kingdom intrinsically built into the way of living in the things of Jesus, that it's about serving. It's about loving. Now, obviously we're about, you know, not abusing people and taking advantage of people's time, none of that stuff. But the point being that serving and service is at the very center of Jesus. And you said something that you probably just, you know, fell out of your mouth that you didn't even realize, which was you said to that team, hey, whatever you need, if this is the area of help, I can do it with and this is the caveat, a good attitude, and I can go all in and be a blessing to you, because that's where you need help, because this really ultimately isn't about me. It's actually about what we're doing in the kingdom together. And I think that attitude, that heart posture needs to be highlighted, because I think more and more, I don't think, I know it's more rare, and it's becoming more rare. And I think it's something that needs to be distilled and instilled into our families and into our friendships, and reminders like, hey, your relationships don't exist about you. We've talked about this recently, about how so many people don't ask good questions any longer, and how sad that is, because so many people have so many interesting stories. I'm thinking about your story today, how intricate it is that you've written however many books on it.
Yeah.
And it will be unending in many ways. And so I just wanted to highlight that. I think that's an important dynamic.
I completely agree with you. And I will say that was probably the main reason you got hired over the other people we're interviewing is because you said, I think you were like, just give me a mop, or do you need me in children's, or whatever it was. Like, I do remember.
I don't remember that.
there is an aspect of weeding out where somebody's like, I'm about the kingdom or I'm about my empire. You know what I mean? And if somebody's like, hey, here's what I really want to do, you're kind of immediately like, I don't think this is going to work. Understanding. Yep. So yeah, if somebody shows up at a church and they're like, whatever, as long as I can just serve the living Jesus and this church family, dude, make them the pastor. You know what I mean? Like, heck yeah, dude.
Yes. Okay. So to get onto the story, because this is where I think a lot of it gets good. So you finally are on staff for 5 years. Is it 5 years
before you go
Plant Collective?
Yeah.
So almost like 5 years. And then finally you make the decision prayerfully, carefully, but with a team of people, with elders, with the crew, and it's decided like, hey, this is time to go plant this church.
Yeah.
And so take us from there. So you go plant a church. What's the church called? Where was it? I know all these answers. I'm just giving.
Yeah.
I just want to remind you, I know the answers, Casey. Give them to us.
What's so funny is, as everybody knows, when you do nutshell versions of a story, there's so much we're leaving out. And so anyway, if we're worried about time, tell me and I can make it even more of a nutshell. But
no, you're good.
All that to say is it was a church that was on the west side of Los Angeles, so the Venice Beach, Santa Monica, Culver City area, so where they filmed Jeopardy. So if anybody has any of those bearings in their mind, yes, as far as a map goes, that's where we ended up. And we checked out San Diego, Austin, Seattle, and Phoenix as possible places to land and plant. And I knew Portland. I couldn't do Portland, dude. I just knew it wasn't. I couldn't do it. But we're just like, God called us to Los Angeles. Los Angeles is big enough for more than one church, or more than one church that's like this. So we ended up on the west side, and I planted with Lorenzo Smith, who knows if anybody knows him, but I'll give him a shout out. And we did this whole thing together, and it was the wildest, craziest, most beautiful, intense ministry I've ever had in my entire life, is planting a church, because there was so much hurt leading up to it for so many different reasons that we can't or shouldn't probably get into regarding why. But to finally get there, it was after years of like feeling called out when you're 15. And then when you show up and I'm like 30, I planted a church at 30, I believe. When you finally show up and you're there and you do it, and you're just like, holy crap. You can edit that. I don't know if you guys say crap, but so it was just,
it's a safe word here.
Yeah. It was just so big. It was so big, and it was so hard, and it was so intense. And I wouldn't trade it for the world, but I'm no longer there.
But but wait, before you get to the climax of that story, you know, one of the things that you're talking about, which I do think is really important, is you had this dream, you had this vision, and God really did lead you to this thing. And I remember being a part of it, part of Sydney. I was on the team when you were leaving, and on the it was a sad, it was like a yay / this is terrible. My friend Casey's leaving and he's going to do this thing, and it's not, I'm not going to be in this normal rhythm with him any longer.
To be fair, and I asked you to come with me.
I think maybe you did. Yeah. I can't remember that fully, but I'm sure yeah, I'm sorry that I should have said yes. You know, looking back, I'm really questioning my life choices at this point. but you went and you did it. The dream in some ways is being fulfilled. But I remember, I ended up moving back to Portland, and you were planting this church. And I remember some of our phone calls and some of the wonderful, long, deep, hard, sad, hard phone calls that we had about how this dream that you wanted so badly that was finally fulfilled, how in many ways it was crushing parts of you. Maybe speak to that. Maybe I'm remembering it wrong. If I am, please adjust it. But
God allowed me to be broken. And he did it through so many different things. And if I can, I'll just tell them very quickly, just so people can see.
Yes, but, please.
You know, I don't want to get too graphic, so I'll avoid some of it. But let's just say some stuff happened with my mother and her current husband that just wrecked me. And my mom had to come live with us. There was some theological stuff that I had to take a stand for with some people in our church who decided to paint the town red. There's some of the closest people who planted the church with turned, and I don't want to say turned on me, but just turned and decided to, you know, whatever. I don't want to get into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All that to say is there was this massive climax of a moment that just shattered me. And it was, you know, what's that Spurgeon quote that even being thrown against the rocks is grace and it's a gift. And so I see that now. And, all that trauma then caught up like a moving train and just hit a brick wall all in a single moment. And, I took a 4-year sabbatical, but it wasn't a sabbatical like, hey, I'm going to go hang out and fish in Montana every day. What truly was, I did 3 or 4 intensives in Colorado. I was in therapy, twice a week, 3 to 4 hours a session. Okay. I did healing prayers on Monday and I had to drive 2 hours away for that every Monday. I had to read certain books. I had to work out a certain amount of time. I had to write daily reports. A lot of it I don't agree with. And a lot of it I'm glad I got to do. But all that to say was I came back with a limp. I wrestled with God. I came back with a limp. And the percentage of which I could still do ministry was significantly less. And for a church plant, they need somebody who can be a higher percentage. So to give you false fake numbers, I came back at a 39. The church needed somebody who's like, oh, we need somebody who's an 80 to 100. And I knew that. And I had energy. God had done amazing healing work with me. I felt completely new. My redefinitions of pastor were put inside of me. But realizing what the church needed, what my co-pastor needed, and realizing I wasn't the God to bring it there was a very coming to Jesus moment. And what I mean by that is I learned diligently and beautifully, there's a reason Moses couldn't go in the promised land. I learned there's a reason David couldn't build the temple. I learned all these different things that whatever your dream could be, it's not going to be found in this. Whatever your answer that you want, whatever it is your biggest dream is, must be first placed in God. And so giving that over, giving over the Isaac, giving over the temple, giving over the promised land, and just being okay with it, like I have God, was the greatest realization and gift I've ever been given.
And what did you, so you quit?
I quit. Well, I first told my co-pastor, I said, I came.
Obviously there was a process.
Yes. Yeah, I first told my co-pastor, I came back and I said, I'm going to give it a year with this limp. A year came and I said, hey, dude, I still got the limp. And I go, I think I need to quit. And he goes, give me another year to find your replacement. And I said, you got it. And I did it. And so I was there 2 years after my sabbatical, 4 months of just insane work, therapy the entire time, working on myself, learning the whole false to true self, all of that stuff. Everything from Richard Rohr to Richard Foster, whatever you want to say, all of it was burned inside of me. And I had energy. Like I said, this is not a tale of burnout. This is not what this is. You know, we talk so much in ecclesiological circles about perseverance or don't say, you know, stop or what, or don't stop. We don't talk enough about when somebody should stop. That's what needs to be brought back into church pastoral circles is when do you know when your time is done? And I hate that that's not a part of more common chats amongst vocational ministers. So I decided to leave, and it wasn't leave this church. It was, I'm going to go away from being a pastor, theologian, counselor, whatever, and just be the son of God. Just be not Jesus, the son of God, and just be a son of God. And I've been in that
great state. Word choice.
I've been in that state since 2019.
Wow. So you gave up the dream.
I did.
And you gave up the gift for the gift giver, some might say. And how has your life, I mean, you kind of said it, but basically it was the best thing you could have done is what I'm hearing you say. Am I putting words in your mouth?
I'll also just say this. Yeah, it's the best thing I've ever done, but I know probably, you know, there's got to be a way where if I would have persevered, that also would have been the best thing I've ever done. I still don't know to this day if I made the right decision. I took the wisdom I had. I took the people I had. I took the brooks who I talked in my backyard with weekly for hours on end. And I put all of that in a giant boiling pot. And I said, okay, I'm going to make the best decision I possibly can. Where every day I think about that church, where still to this day, not in a dark, gross way, I think about my decision. I just think about, because that was my entire life leading to that moment. And then in it, what felt like an instant, I said goodbye. And so there's a lot of mourning still I constantly do, but there's also a lot of celebrating. I'm happy they have somebody who has a higher percentage than me. You know what I mean? So best decision as to what I think the decision should have been or whatever it is. Sure. I'm just celebrating that they're okay and I'm okay. And Jesus is in the midst of this all. And so.
Yeah. So what did this evolve in you? So now what I'd like to transfer to is, you know, you're giving up this dream. Now what has emerged? C.S. Fritz, tell us what has emerged from this, this surrender. You know, Isaac, I think that's a great example.
Yeah.
You were asked to give up something that was really, really important to you.
Yeah.
I remember, do you remember the conversation that we had? Because it reminds me of it, even as we're talking about it. And I remember it vividly because it was impactful for me how you were ingesting it. But I think we were talking about the prayer of relinquishment. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah. You introduced me to Richard Foster, who I've consumed everything since then. I am obsessed with him. But yeah, from his book on prayer.
Yeah,
I'll never forget that conversation.
That's so fun. Oh, well, that's an incredible honor. He has a book around simplicity. Have you read this book?
Yeah.
Power of Simplicity. Yeah. Oh, never mind. You're probably deeper dive than I have.
Literally,
you ask
every
me what
book.
I have read.
I've done it all. I'm obsessed.
Yeah. So. But I remember that conversation because that is the picture that I always get. And if you're listening and you're like, what are they talking about? It's simply the prayer of relinquishment is the idea that we take all the things that we, our dreams, our hopes, our future, our life, and we just, simply release them. We relinquish them to God's control and power. Yeah. And the visual that I think Richard Foster gives, if you remember, and remind me, you fill in the gaps if I'm off here. But the visual that we are literally relinquishing them, we're letting God bury those dreams and saying, we allow you to resurrect whatever's of you.
100%.
And whatever, so whatever needs to stay buried. And his point, I think if I remember right, was something along the lines of, there's going to be things that are resurrected that you expected, that you're like, oh, that makes sense. But then there's going to be stuff that comes out of there that you're like, whoa, I would have not expected that. And then maybe things that you were like, of course, that's going to be there, that stay buried and they don't come out anymore. And as I'm hearing you process this, I'm picking up really that is partly what happened. You relinquished these things, these potential, good things can become idols very easily, right? But seems like God had a different story or a different plan, at least for this season of your life. And the reason I can say that is because I see immense fruit from your life. And so I just want to say very loud so everyone can hear. I won't lift the volume of my voice, but I will say it in the sense of loudness, in the sense of its reach, that what you're doing and what you're contributing in the space of art and the space of literature and as an author is a huge gift to people. Mm-hmm. And it's transforming, it's putting things into the world that are going to outlive you, and you're helping families see that. And so you've been writing, you're an author. So tell me what kind of has evolved since, you closed that chapter. That chapter was done as far as leading a church, doing the thing you wanted, planting a church. And what has emerged?
Yeah,
I know what one thing's emerged is that you don't have a phone and you're almost impossible to get a hold of. I love that / hate that.
Yeah, getting rid of a phone is an absolute joy. Yeah. But as far as emerge, I went through a pretty, just so you know, I don't want people to think I jumped from hell to paradise. Like there was a 9-month period, a 12-month period of me just working at a metal shop from 6 to 2 every day, where I popped on headphones and I just cried about my decision. And I just listened to podcast sermons every day with headphones on. You're not allowed to talk to anybody in a metal shop finishing metal. And so I needed that detox. Then COVID hit, so on and so forth. And we started having to think creatively. And so went down this whole path of designing covers, designing books. My wife was a school teacher. COVID hit. She needed some extra income. And it just stumbled and rumbled and rolled all the way into this little book craft hybrid publishing company, which allowed us to not have to fall into the Christian market standards of what a Christian book is. And we wanted to tell stories. Our whole goal of our company, which is called Albatross Book Co., is to just tell anything that takes a risk. If your story takes a risk and everybody turns you away, we're more interested in your story, or your book or your project. So I've still done children's books. I still doing children's books, and we can talk about those all day, but we're starting to venture out into a poetry book I did called Moth, a horror novel that we just released, all at the same time, which is wildly redemptive, but at the same time, not your average, what you'd expect Christian book.
So I want to, so you write these, you have Goodnight Classics, which is a great one. Right. And you, what I love is that you've taken all these classic stories and you've rewrote them or added. Well, I won't say for you. What was your vision behind Goodnight Classics?
Yeah, Goodnight Classics, Goodnight Tales, Goodnight Classics is a sequel. The vision was, I think it was, to be honest, I was a little, I don't know if the right word is frustrated, but disheartened and saddened by families which demonized things that weren't overtly Christian. So everything from Harry Potter to Star Wars to whatever was, is I wanted to be able to show that Christ can be found in the oldest of stories. Redemption, light and darkness can be found in the oldest of stories. And let me highlight that for you by retelling how Hansel and Gretel is a story of temptation. Let me re-highlight how Jack and the Beanstalk is a story of greed, or Three Little Pigs is a story of foundations. And so we did this in such a way where he tells these stories, but it's all done through the eyes of these interlude stories of Pinocchio about a boy who doesn't know what life is. And so this father creates this creature who runs away from him, and this father's trying to tell him stories. And then over the course of time of learning these stories, he understands his own. And spoiler alert, the wooden boy becomes a heart of flesh. And so that was my goal with that one, was to really enlighten people going, let me give you the tools to be able to find Jesus in every single story that's ever been told.
Yes. And you've even done this. You've done this in other books that you've written for sure. The Moon Man Cometh is another one. Mm-hmm. And you told me something that was right before we hit record. You told me something that was really, I think, eye-opening, that, you know, each one of these stories is actually your stories. Your story in the redemption that Jesus comes in and plays. It's your story in one way or another, all the way into where you decided to write a book called A Fig for All Devils.
A Fig for All the Devils. Yeah.
For All the Devils. Excuse me. I apologize. I wrote that down wrong. We had this joke and it actually happened, and I'm sorry. I was like, why don't I just butcher every single one of your book titles? I'll say them and then it'll just be one word off. I'm so sorry. But that said, you know, that is such a different direction. So just tell me, and what's interesting is this book specifically, you just won an award for this book, which is incredible. Congratulations for that. That's an incredible gift. But I know that there's like even, there's a film being talked about for this one. Is that correct? Am I understanding that right? And as well as like, you're in the process. This is just gaining a ton of traction, but tell me where this came from. Give me the backstory of that and like where that kind of derived for you.
If anybody knows any of my stories from Cottonmouth and the River to the Moon Man Cometh, they're going to realize that I'm a complete fraud. And I tell the same story over and over with different characters. And I'm a total, I'm a total phony fraud. And what I mean by that is, it's a story of an abused orphan boy, lonely, abandoned, and hates life. And his parents are whatever. And he just prays for an inbreaking of any kind. And I always write that inbreaking in a very incarnational inbreaking done through these different monsters. You know, there's monsters and the Moon Man all the way to A Fig for All the Devils about a 13-year-old boy, where the Grim Reaper breaks in the form of death and seeks to give the boy something to do with his angst, because the Grim Reaper needs a successor. Death is looking for a successor. So A Fig for All the Devils, more importantly, in my opinion, though, is because it's a direct memoir. It's based where I grew up. Everybody in there is a real person, and all the abusive situations are verbatim my story. Verbatim. So
wow.
to be able to write that and to see that get awards and a movie deal is mind-boggling because it's my story. But to be able to write that and then write what you wish could have happened to the stepdad and all those things, it was just freaking magical.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and in one sense, what I hear you saying is obviously there's a redemption yep. in this, and
a Christ-like redemptive.
Even within a book like A Fig for All the Devils, like you actually it's your story and there's a redemption piece in it. Now I need to say, we need to be clear that this is not a book for everybody. It is kind of intense. Yeah. And what I also love is that you illustrate everything.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I think is also incredible is that you don't only write, but you also illustrate, and all of that's from you, which I think is an incredible feat, especially because of the design is honestly, it's incredible. It's powerful is a good way to say it. But all that said, we all process this story different. And what I want to say, thank you for being honest and sharing your story. Before we jump out of here, I just want to ask just like an important question. And I think it's, in one sense, you've kind of answered it, but I think I'd love to ask it directly so that you can have a moment to maybe answer it a little more directly. And what are you hoping, you know, with some of these books and some of the things happening, and maybe even, you know, the movie, the different things that are coming out.
Yeah.
What are you hoping and desiring to impact the world with? What would you hope by your presence in the world, what would you hope to leave the world with a taste of as you're contributing to all these different factors or different, you're giving all these different offerings to the world right now? What would you hope to do?
In a roundabout answer, I think one of my favorite ideologies or attributes of God is the hiddenness of God. It is maturing, and it's what it does to the person in the Christian faith. And it's just a beautiful aspect of scripture. And even if you look at scripture as a whole, how it seems Christ slowly disappears or God slowly disappears in the Old Testament, there's something crazy beautiful about this. I take that to say, that's what I want people to come away with, Christian or not, skeptic or not, family, child, whatever age, horror, all the way to children's fantasy, is God is somewhere in these pages. Jesus is in these pages, and it's a horrifying story that has this. Jesus is in that. If Jesus and God is not in all, then he's not God. If God is not in the bad, then he's not God in the good. And so I want people to know that what I say, everything said about Goodnight Classics, that Jesus can be pulled from this. He can even be pulled from this, from a horror story, that which was my life. It was an absolute horror story. So finding Jesus between the lines, finding Jesus in the darkness, finding Jesus in the bloodshed and anguish and turmoil, dude, sign me up.
He's there.
That's all I want. That's He's what there. I want everybody to know.
Wow. Wow, Casey. That is a great way to end. I just want to thank you for your time. Thank you for all you're contributing to the world. It's been an honor to talk with you and catch up. It's one of the only times I can see you, because now that you don't have a phone, there's just, you know, it's lucky if I can ever get you, man. I'm teasing.
Brooke, I love you. I love your ministry. I love your family. I love everything you're doing. And I'm your gift, or you're the greatest gifts that God has given me, is our friendship. It's a real, real friendship. Not ones that fades away. You are ever present and so kind to me. So I'm very grateful for you in this time.
Love you, buddy. So appreciate this chat. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If this podcast has blessed you in any way, here's a few ways that you can partner with us in this ministry. First is to give. Intentional Parents is a nonprofit, and we rely on the generous giving of our partners. So please head over to our website, intentionalparents.org/give, if you would like to become one of our partners through giving. Second is to share it. If this has at all been helpful to you, we encourage you to share it with your friends, your family, and those that you know would be blessed by it. Third is to follow us on social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You can find us on Instagram at intentional_parents. And lastly, if you would head over to iTunes, if you enjoyed today's episode, and leave a review on iTunes, this helps us bring more hope, help, and healing for families.